Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the invitation, Syria. It's great to be here at Perimeter. Acknowledge that this is kind of a joint visit with Department of Math at Pure Math at Waterloo. So thanks to Ruxandra for hosting me there. And so people were treated to a very different talk yesterday at Waterloo, which was on resolutions of singularities and Nakajima quiver varieties. It's very different. So the few people who are both, you see something completely different now. So, well, not everything is connected, but still. So this is a talk about, roughly speaking, what one might term quantum matter and its relationship to algebraic geometry, maybe some ideas from algebraic geometry, which is maybe, more where I come from. But ideas in algebraic geometry that one can leverage to perhaps come up with some enhanced or in some ways substantially different models of quantum matter. I think, this goes without explanation for this audience, but of course, algebraic geometry has many fruitful interactions with physics, particularly high energy physics, and usually within mirror symmetry in that context. And so, especially with regards to constructing, mirror pairs in the Clabial-Fano settings, you have robust algebraic and arithmetic programs in this setting. You have the toric mirror symmetry of Badyarev-Borisov. You've got Landau-Ginzburg models. You have the Gross-Schubert program. There are other approaches, of course. I'm just emphasizing these because they're somehow highly algebraic or highly arithmetic. And of course, in terms of organizing gauge theories, you have quiver theoretic descriptions which tie in quiver varieties with gauge theories. So, these are all well-trodden things, and people here, of course, are experts on these things. But, you could sort of put all of this aside and ask, well, what about something like solid-state physics, or condensed matter physics? And here, I don't mean as an using algebra-geometric techniques as an organizing principle. What I mean is, can we understand individual materials themselves somehow from an algebra-geometric lens? And I say this also because there's been a lot of work recently on algebra-topological approaches in solid-state physics. So I'll say a little bit about that. Okay, but maybe one thing is perhaps to come to some agreement about what it means to be holding in one's hand a quantum material. Okay, so this is a fairly amorphous term, and it means many things to many different people. I think it's one of these things that is not necessarily defined in any sort of consistent way, but I guess we have some rough understanding of what it means for a material to be quantum, a physical material. I think traditionally, this refers to strongly correlated systems of electrons, but maybe they're best defined by what they're not. I'd say that these are materials that have behaviors that have no counterpart in the macroscopic world. These behaviors are usually emergent ones that come from unusual dependences of the four quantum numbers, charge, spin, orbit, and lattice. And this sort of unusual or diagonal dependence between these is often induced under some very precise or extreme conditions. So for instance, one could maybe try to use certain elements to engineer some very, let's say, thin or really thin films of highly crystalline materials, which you might then subject to some supercooling. That could mean many different things. It could mean on the order of millikelvin, or it could mean something else. And then you might subject it to a very strong transverse magnetic field to induce a quantum Hall type effect. But of course, we also have the anomalous quantum Hall effect without the presence of such a field. But in any case, there's some maybe set of unusual conditions might in certain materials lead to some unusual behaviors. And then this is really the domain of quantum materials. So maybe to give just some very, very concrete examples, okay? And here this maybe depends on the interest and expertise of people in the room. This might be very, very familiar or it might not be. But some common examples maybe of quantum materials would be, for instance, spin liquids. So these are crystalline materials. So these are solid crystalline materials, but in which the spin of atomic components are disordered and dynamically fluctuating, not something you would expect or associate with a crystalline material. And this is the sense in which it's liquid. So a class of examples come from the titanate pyrochlores, like ytterbium titanium oxide. You have spin glasses. These are magnetic materials in which the spins are random. You wouldn't expect that randomness in these magnetic materials. So iridium, manganese, gallium is an example. Under the right conditions, it can become a spin glass. And then the one that's perhaps most interesting to this talk and maybe this group are topological materials. So these are materials with robust band gap structures, right, manifesting in protected insulating or conducting states. So an example of this could be, for instance, in two dimensions, so a thin film of mercury telluride sandwiched in cadmium telluride, that's a topological insulator. In three dimensions, you have bismuth antimony, that's another topological insulator, again, under the right conditions. Okay. So these materials, they're theoretical prediction, but also their manifestation, their experimental realization, was the subject of a Nobel Prize in Physics in 2016. I think that's where I first started to wonder what this was all about. So here's the Nobel Prize Committee trying to explain topology to people by tearing apart pastries. I think that the most interesting part of this picture is the spelling of topology. So they're a very learned committee, but no one proofread their slides. But in any case, you know, these have attracted quite a bit of attention. This is a Nature a news article from a few years after that Nobel Prize. So strange topological materials popping up everywhere physicists look. Here is a thin film of a graphene-like material, but with some purposeful defects introduced. Okay. The hexagonal lattice is sort of telltale of graphene. So there are hundreds of such materials known and governed by a periodic table of a sorts that's organized algebra-topologically. So here's maybe the earliest instance of such a table, and this is from work of Kitaev. You know, on the mathematics side, you know, we have work. I'm not going to explain at all what's happening in this table, but I'll just advertise on the mathematical side. You have work of people like Fried and Hopkins and Theo, you know, of Perimeter, who have, you know, taken this in some ways much, much further using further techniques from topology. But my question is not really about topology. It's more about geometry. And so, you know, maybe the coarsest question here is, are there other kinds of quantum materials that are sort of just beyond the topological regime that you might maybe call algebra-geometric materials, okay, which depend on geometric invariance in a sense, algebra-geometric invariance rather than topological ones. So one way to sort of coax this out is to go back to the beginning. You know, the beginning of all of this, in some sense of all of solid-state physics, is the work of Bloch in 1928. So waves propagating in a periodic medium with a symmetric potential, so meaning a potential that's invariant under the translation group of the medium, are determined up to phase by their behavior in the fundamental cell. They can be decomposed into modes that are determined themselves by the fundamental their behavior in the fundamental cell of this periodic medium. And this theorem of Bloch, which is very powerful, and this, you know, at the interface of PDEs and representation theory in physics, you know, it's kind of it's well known. I think physics undergraduates will encounter at least some version of this in undergraduate condensed matter courses or solid state physics courses, sort of at least maybe by the end of their degrees. So certainly encounter it in graduate school. It's a very interesting and rich mathematical theorem that most mathematicians don't encounter for whatever reason. But it's fundamental to describing any kind of wave propagation in a periodic medium. And it's not a strictly quantum idea. It describes the behavior of any type of wave in any periodic medium. You can even use it to describe acoustic waves. But its application to electron motion in crystalline solids is really what underpins, you know, modern sort of electronic theory. So this is really the beginning of the band theory of electric conduction, and it can be used to explain various kinds of phenomena like quantum Hall type phenomena. So if we want to just sort of unpack for a moment with Bloxy and Rebecca. Again, you know, this is a very mixed audience, and some people think about this constantly, and you know, this is old hat, and for others this might be new. But just in an effort to put things, if nothing else, into a common notation, for instance, let's start with Rn, okay, Euclidean space, and maybe tile that with a regular lattice, which I'll call lambda. Okay, so here I can obtain any cell by I pick a fundamental one, and I can obtain the rest of space by translating it. So what we want to do is consider eigenvalue problems that respect the symmetry of this lattice. So by that, I mean, I'm going to take a function, okay, from Rn, a real-valued function on Rn, maybe smooth, let's say, that's invariant, okay, with respect to the lattice, and I want to consider this operator H, okay, so a Hamiltonian, which is just minus the Laplacian plus this invariant function. And then I want to consider the eigenvalue problem for this. So here are the eigenfunctions, or what we'll call the wave functions, and then here are the eigenvalues, the energies. So the Hilbert space of square of L2 functions on Rn, so that's where I'll be looking for wave functions. So this Hilbert space has an induced action of, now I'm identifying the lattice with its translation group. I'm just going to call that lambda. This Hilbert space has an induced action, which just comes from translation of coordinates. And then this Hilbert space, which I'm calling L, splits into irreducible representations, which I'll denote L sub k, of the group. The group is abelian, so all of the representations are one-dimensional. The important thing is that each of these representations is generated by a quasi-invariant function. So this is a function that's defined, let's say, just on the fundamental cell. And how it looks outside the fundamental cell, it's not invariant. It doesn't look the same necessarily in a neighboring cell. But if I've translated by lambda, little lambda, then it picks up a phase factor. And so here, this just needs to be defined up to the circle. And so these are just functions from the group to the circle. Now, translation by any element is an isometry, and so let's say the translation operator then is unitary, commutes with the Laplacian, and the translation operator and the potential commute by definition because of the invariance. So what we're saying is that the overall operator, the Hamiltonian, diagonalizes in the basis of irreducible representations for L, and that means that general solutions then for the eigenvalue problem can be written in terms of basis vectors of these representations, which are these quasi-invariant waves, known as Bloch wave functions. So you have a decomposition of arbitrary L2 waves into these modes, these Bloch wave modes. So just this is a visual representation. Just let's take two dimensions. And so I have some lattice here, some 2D lattice. So here's a phi sub k defined on what I've picked to be the fundamental cell. And I'm going to translate everything by lambda, and then the solution just transforms by e to the ik lambda, where k is this choice of, if you like, representation of the group capital lambda. So this is a very powerful theorem, you know, saying that when we regard the eigenvalue problem as a Schrodinger equation for electrons propagating in a periodic medium on Rn with a symmetric potential, then we have a description of the wave function for this, let's say, single electron dynamics in terms of data that depends only on the lattice, or equivalently only on the topology of the quotient of Rn by the translation group, which is the effective space, if you like, where the electrons are propagating. So I just want to now go to the two-dimensional case of this, and that's where we're going to spend the entirety of this talk. So I'm going to consider the Euclidean plane now, which I'll identify with C, and here's my lattice, again, lambda. And I'm going to have, again, a lambda periodic potential, okay, which I'm going to think of as a function from C to R. Now, the eigenvalue problem, everything we said before applies here. This is just a special case. So the eigenvalue problem is solved in the basis of representations from lambda into U1, which are parametrized by now the dual torus of C mod lambda. If you like, the dual elliptic curve, because that's really what we're talking about. We have a specific lattice on R2 or on C, so C mod lambda is an elliptic curve, and these representations live in the Jacobian, in the dual elliptic curve. Okay. And you know, we can Fourier transform this entire problem. Everything was written in spatial coordinates x, but we can Fourier transform this whole problem so that it's written in k coordinates now. So I'm going to use k itself as a coordinate, and this is what we would call momentum coordinates, And so the space of K's is what we call the crystal momentum space, or the Brillouin zone. This is the condensed matter terms. I mean, to the mathematicians, it's just the Jacobian, or it's just the dual elliptic curve. And this is where the spectra, or the energy bands in the problem are studied. They're usually studied over the momentum space. I mean, some people study it over real space, but I think most people would study it over momentum space. Okay. So this is really a story about two tori. Okay, so you have, this is the position space where the electrons are effectively propagating. And then this is where these solutions are actually, these modes in which the solutions can be written are living. And I should say that let me just go back slightly. You know, once you've fixed appropriate periodic boundary conditions, these phi sub k's are completely determined on the fundamental cells. So the only ways in which these modes are evolving are through the choices of these representations k. Okay, so in some sense, the solution space really is, you know, the solution space are honestly the wave functions, but they're decomposed into data that just comes completely from here where the k's live. And so in some sense, this is really the solution space of the problem. And this was this Fourier transform I mentioned. And so if we're going to work then completely in momentum space, so I'm really using the k's as coordinates instead of the x's, and then one could look at the energy bands plotted over the momentum torus. And this is a typical thing that happens in the condensed matter theory. So here's a cartoon. Okay, so this is like I've picked, you know, some interval of k values on this torus. I've just picked some copy of the interval that's embedded in here. And so that's my base coordinate here. And then here I'm looking at the energy bands. Okay. And so these are two different pictures that describe two different types of phenomena. So a key thing here, so these are this is actually a grouping of energy levels. These are the filled bands. These are the unfilled bands. So I've kind of grouped them into two pieces here. And that's also typical. So conduction and valence bands, if you like. A key feature of this, and this is just mathematical. You know, these energy bands, or these ones and these ones, just came from solving the eigenvalue problem. It's just purely mathematical. This mu here is a little bit where the actual physics of the material in some sense enters. So this is the Fermi level, or the electrochemical potential. So this is what the electrons really need to leap over in order to jump to the higher bands. And so the difference in these pictures is really to do with how mu interacts with these two sets of bands. Here I have a big gap between the filled and the unfilled bands, and mu lies squarely between it. In that gap, whereas here you have what looks like a gap, but really mu is crossing between the filled and the unfilled bands. Okay, and so you have in some sense it's very easy in this setting for electrons to jump, and so this is really characterizing two different kinds of conductivity phenomena as sort of simply as possible in terms of a mostly mathematical picture. So this is maybe what you would refer to as an insulator, and this is maybe what you'd refer to as a metal. And so we can think about this as a mathematical distinction. And this is a line of thinking that's been very, very profitable over many, many years. Okay. And so just to inject reality into this, you know, you could ask, you know, can I take an actual material and look at pictures like this? So sure, here's silicon. Okay, so this is a picture of the band gap geometry of silicon. So this is, again, you see k coordinates and you see energy coordinates, and this is what maybe the local band gap structure might look like in a particular sample. Yeah. But of course, this picture is not, you know, is not one dimensional. You know, these tori are one complex dimension or two real dimension. So you can sort of pull out and try and look at the actual geometry. So here's maybe a less cartoony, more honest picture of what's going on in some material. So here, this ring here again is the electrochemical potential, and these are, if you like, the filled bands and the unfilled bands. Okay? And you have points of degeneracy where energy levels are coming together. Okay, so this is somehow a more honest picture. And if you pull out even further from this, then you know this is really forming a surface that's covering as a branched cover. your momentum elliptic curve. Okay, so then this could be some higher genus Riemann surface. Now you could ask, is it really a Riemann surface? Does it have really the structure of a Riemann surface? And in some sense it does. So this there's a paper of Hatsugai, which is I think pretty important here, but the Riemann surface of the Bloch energy levels, at least in the case of the integer quantum Hall effect. But so there's a good let's say class of examples in which you can think about this as having globally as being a compact object with the structure of a Riemann surface. Okay, so that's everything you just said is purely done standard physics, just maybe worded in a way that you wouldn't find usually in the condensed matter literature. I just worded things in a way that is maybe somewhat appealing to geometers. Okay. But once you start doing that, you can start to ask naive questions. As I said, this was really for two-dimensional topological materials. And maybe I should say one more thing just to make some connection with the buzz about topological materials. So, when the topology of this branched covering is what completely determines whether it's an insulator or a metal, and no other effects come into play. There's all kinds of physical effects that might come into play. But if it's only the topology of this branch covering, and we don't care where these points of degeneracy or these branchings are, just maybe how many are there, and then that can be captured as a Chern class of this surface. Okay. The Chern class of this surface will control how it's branched over the surface below. So if that number is purely determining the conductivity profile of the material, then it's a topological material. The fact that such materials exist is what's really important and why there's a Nobel Prize for this, in a sense. Okay. Now, you can ask a naive question. We said that this was really a story about two elliptic curves. So is there any sense in which you can engineer the position space to have genus, say G, bigger than one? So we see higher genus curves appearing, but that's coming from the geometry of the filled and unfilled bands. That's coming as a cover of one of these elliptic curves. But can I make, say, the position curve a curve of genus G bigger than one? It's sort of just a kind of naive question that a geometer might ask. So the question is, if I really want my position space to be something, say genus two, can I recover the rest of the theory that we just presented, and can we have something? Is there a first of all, what is the momentum phase space? The existence of this depends on, remember, this came from having Bloch wave functions from quasi periodic. A basis of quasi-periodic solutions. Do we have anything like that here? And then do the rest of the features come into play? So this is an interesting question from a mathematical point of view. You could ask if it's interesting from a physical point of view. Would it even make sense to engineer such materials? We can talk about that later, but let's sort of deal with the mathematical question first. Okay, so as a package of questions then, you could ask, can we engineer a higher genus position space? Is there a corresponding crystal momentum or Brillouin zone? And is there a band theory? Is there a solid band theory here? Okay, well, the first thing is that, if you want to have a genus G bigger than one position space, you're going to need a tiling with a higher gonality, a tiling with a larger number of sides than, say, 4 or 6. So these tori we saw in my picture, I had a parallelogram tiling, if you like, you could have a hexagonal tiling. You'll still produce something genus G equal to 1, but that's important because, like I said, graphene is an example of a hexagonal lattice. So we're going to have to go even higher than that if we want to produce a genus G bigger than 1 position space. So to produce a genus G position space in general, we'll have to tile 2D space by 4 G-gons. I shouldn't say we must tile. These come in groups of four. So, you know, like seven, eight, 9 and 11 will all produce something genus 2, but we'll just take multiples of 4 then and just look at 4 times the genus. So to get genus 2, you know, we want to tile space by regular octagons. Okay, so try that. Okay, but you're going to get something that looks like this. Okay, there's a problem here, as we know. Okay, if you take regular octagons, you know, you're not going to be able to tile completely. You'll always have this empty space, these little squares. That's fine. You could say, okay, well then we can't do it. And you just say, okay, we're done. So the talk is done. No, that's not what we do. You just replace Euclidean space with hyperbolic space, and then you tile by Poincaré regular octagons. So this is 2D space with the Poincaré metric. And these are perfectly regular with respect to that metric, just not to our Euclidean eyes. And so I guess you have to invoke Escher at this point, and everyone has to put up an image like this. Okay. But then here's a good image showing the how you might start identifying sides so that you can get a genus two surface. Okay, so we're now starting to enter, if we can make certain mathematical things work out, then we're starting to enter a regime that you might call hyperbolic matter. So here we're going to a hyperbolic lattice instead of a Euclidean lattice. So here we're tiling the hyperbolic plane by 4 g-gons, and now again we're going to choose the first step then. Okay, you've tessellated the hyperbolic plane. You need to choose a periodic potential. And such things exist. These are really now. Well, let me say the next thing first, and I'll come back to the periodicity. So, the translation group of the tessellation. One of the maybe interesting features is now non-abelian. Okay, it's a Fuchsian group. So a discrete subgroup of PSU 1-1. But these are in general non-abelian now. So that's a wrinkle in things. You do have periodic potentials for such groups. These are really like generalized Eisenstein series. So again, here's such a picture, and with fundamental sides, and we're going to do identifications of opposite sides. Now, the next thing we need to do is update our Hamiltonian. So we've picked this potential V. And I'm going to now, instead of the Laplacian, I'm going to take the Laplace-Beltrami operator. So this is adapted to the Poincaré metric. So it satisfies this relationship with the original Laplacian. Okay. And I guess the next question we might ask is, do there exist Bloch waves? Okay. And so the answer there is yes. These are really just the simplest automorphic forms for the group gamma. So we're just looking at wave functions, say defined on the fundamental cell, if you like, in this example, the fundamental octagon, and which transform, when I translate the coordinate by something in the symmetry group gamma, then it picks up a factor now, and this factor again is just a map. It's a representation of the group into U1. So this is a factor of automorphy that depends only on the group element, but not on the position. And so it's in a trivial sense an automorphic form of weight zero, because it doesn't depend on position. I fix a group element, and now I have a constant but non-vanishing function on the quotient H mod gamma, which is our genus G surface. And so this is automatically holomorphic with respect to this complex structure, because it's just a constant constant function. And so this is just a very simple automorphic form. So these simplest automorphic forms play the role of Bloch wave function. I should say that they actually do satisfy the eigenvalue problem, so that these exist and they solve the equations. So that's good. Now, this is not saying yet that we have anything like a Bloch's theorem. I'm not saying that things decompose. These are modes for a decomposition of all of the L2 functions on this. I'm just saying that we have modes. So So again, the reduced position space here, we've engineered it to be the genus G surface H mod gamma, where G is bigger bigger than or equal to 2. And you might declare the abelian Brillouin zone to be the space of these representations. The group is non-abelian, but these things are U1 valued. So you know, you might say that we still have some sort of abelian Brillouin zone made up by these modes. So, and I was saying earlier, this carries a specific complex structure. And by the way, I just want to also say something in the context of the original 2D Euclidean band theory. You know, again, you know, we talk about the position torus, the momentum torus, but these really are elliptic curves because they came from a particular choice of lattice. Okay, and you could ask something like, does the modulus of the lattice in just in the original Euclidean theory, does the modulus of the elliptic curve actually enter the physical theory somewhere? And it does. It enters in the Hall viscosity. Okay, so you see the size of the lattice manifesting there. So, you know, in that sense, this was always a geometric theory to begin with, and not just a topological one. I just wanted to emphasize that. Okay.
Well, sorry. Can I ask a question?
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. So you can hear me, right?
Yeah, I can. I can hear you. I was just looking for where the voice was coming from. I see the speaker. I don't see you, the human speaker. So, I see the electronic speaker.
Yeah, I'm online.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so I'm just this disembodied voice. Well, it's good that you mentioned that you basically get this 2G genus position space by quotienting out the upper half plane.
Yeah,
right?
Genus G.
So, yeah. Genus G, yeah. So, it's just that, like in the usual band theory, like Euclidean band theory, we consider R2 or C because we're looking at the bulk of the crystal,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
But here, if you want to look at like hyperbolic band theory, you kind of want to look at a material whose bulk, quote unquote, is the upper half plane, which doesn't really make much sense.
Mm.
Because there's a boundary, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, okay, so there's this other theory, which is kind of developed by Bellassard and Marcoli. I don't know if you're familiar, that says that effectively, in some sense or another, I don't really know what their argument is, but their argument is that effectively, electrons see the lattice as hyperbolic when you have, like, Coulomb interaction or something like that. Are you familiar with that? Because I really want somebody to like explain that to me.
No, I mean, I know that this work exists, and someone else has mentioned it to me too, but I haven't looked into it. But I would also love to know more about it.
Yeah. It's just that in their paper, they just kind of state that. They mm-hmm. don't like give a physical argument for it, but good.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question because yeah, I was aware of this kind of other approach to hyperbolic materials here, or band theory. Maybe I mean I need to look into it more myself. So maybe we can chat further about that.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for asking. Thanks for reminding me about that actually. Okay, so. So we know that the space of
can I do some not a Billy representation?
Oh, they're coming. Yeah. Yes, we can't get away without them in this setting. So yeah, that'll be in like one or two slides. But at the moment, if we just look at the U1 representations of gamma, we know that these form a 2G dimensional torus. We're still talking about the Jacobian, or the character variety, if you like. Of a Riemann surface H mod gamma, and you know this Jacobian has a distinguished complex structure inherited from H mod gamma, and as we know is a moduli space of holomorphic line bundles. So this is, you know, when you start thinking in these terms, you know you start to, if you like, move from just thinking about these as topological objects to holomorphic objects, and it makes sense because everything here is inheriting particular complex structures that are all compatible with one another. Okay. So if you like. You know, what we're doing is bringing in an interpretation of at least what I call the abelian Brillouin zone as a moduli space of holomorphic data, of holomorphic line bundles on the position space, which is this higher genus Riemann surface. And so this also brings in the idea that the momentum space of a 2D hyperbolic material might be higher dimensional in general than the position curve. So somehow, you know, I have a negatively curved but always two real dimensional position space, but the momentum space might be a Euclidean, you know, flat, you know, it's the Jacobian is a quotient of Euclidean space, if you like, but of higher dimension than the position space. So this point of view, I guess, you know, we started sort of coaxing out with my collaborator Joseph Macheko, who's a condensed matter physicist at Alberta. So this is maybe where we started thinking along these lines. And so, you know, now we have a picture that maybe starts to look like this, but as we just heard in the question, that, you know, this might not actually be capturing the entire Brillouin zone, and you need to consider higher rank representations, which is exactly where I'm going to go next. So these automorphic states that are living, if you like, that are these choices of modes, these on their own, you know, again, in the absence of a Bloch's theorem, these still on their own give rise to energy bands that can be plotted over the Jacobian. We studied these numerically for a tight binding model on what's called the Boltzmann surface. This is a highly symmetric genus 2 Riemann surface. It has the largest automorphism group of all genus 2 curves. And we studied this numerically with both the empty lattice, so that's where you have a lattice, but the potential is zero, and with a generalized Eisenstein series picked for that respects the group of the lattice. And so we did some numerical studies in the same paper. And so here's a schematic of the fundamental cell of the Boltzmann lattice, okay, down to the exact angles that we used. And so here's a finite element discretization, triangularization of the fundamental domain, of the fundamental cell. And so here we're solving the eigenvalue problem, okay, to get the, if you like, the phi sub k, so the generator that's going to then be multiplied by the factors of automorphy when we translate in some direction. So here is a...
What is the genus in this example?
Two.
Two.
Two, yeah. So here is a plot of the energy bands just over just for one of these solutions on the fundamental cell. Yeah. So see at this k equal to zero, which maybe you could identify with the identity in the Jacobian, you have these what looks to be, you know, four say you know lowest eigenvalues, but then you have branching. So you have some degeneracies. These are actually degeneracies. So this is actually kind of a color plot. So this is the fundamental cell. This is the plot of these four energy levels over. So this is constant, and this is So this one's constant. This is this one right here. And then these are the other three, the next three after the ground state, and then this is actually a similar plot, but of the modulus squared of the wave function taken here at this further value of k. Okay. So these four plotted here, and then these four, so this one is still this original state here, but these three were branching off of this one. Okay, so these do not correspond to these three. Okay. But so here's a selection of plots, of sort of heat plots, if you like, of these fundamental modes. And then this was with the empty lattice. This is with the potential turned on. So the blue curves were the original curves with v equal to zero with a non-zero but symmetric potential. The red curves are the new spectra, and this is again modulus squared taken at these four points. Okay, so you can do some interesting numerical calculations, and you know, we wanted to study, you know, the degeneracy, the branching of these energy bands over the Jacobian, but, you know, coming from just modes on the fundamental cell. Okay. But now you want maybe ask about, okay, but how useful is it to have these automorphic functions? Do you have something like a Bloch's theorem? In some sense, you know, on the whole higher genus Riemann surface, I mean, this is a classical and extremely hard question. I mean, mathematicians have been studying, if you like, the spectrum of the Laplace-Beltrami, the L2 spectrum of the Laplace-Beltrami operator for over 100 years. And this is an extremely noisy spectrum, and it's very difficult to understand or characterize. Okay, so and that's without V. That's with V equal to zero. This having V non-zero makes this even harder, in a sense. So this is an extremely non-trivial problem. But you know, maybe you know when you come at this with you know physical motivations. And I'm not saying that the original work into the spectrum didn't have physical motivations, but if you come into it with these physical motivations, you might approach this problem in a slightly different way. So I guess the general question here is, can you decompose any wave function for the hyperbolic crystal into automorphic Bloch waves? So can you, in other words, can you diagonalize this adapted Hamiltonian using quasi-periodic functions? Okay. Well, and again, maybe the approach that comes from these considerations is, well, you know, people can only engineer finite lattices anyway. So maybe we should start with, we're not going to engineer Riemann surface. So maybe we should just start with a finite lattice and then think about a finite version of the hyperbolic Bloch theorem. I don't mean a discrete version. I mean just a version that only uses finitely many cells. Okay. So consider a tight binding model with finitely many cells. So here's what I mean. So here's a fundamental cell. And then here are my you know sort of other eight octagons, okay? And then this is just a finite model for such a material. Maybe you could take this further a few more rings around the outside, but you know you're going to stop somewhere. And so here we were able to construct, if you like, by hand, a complete basis of quasi-periodic wave functions. But you know you start to see matrix-valued phase factors, which is exactly your question. So you see necessarily. When you try to write down, a wave function for the finite lattice in terms of modes, you see that you have to go to UR-valued modes. Okay? And so, roughly speaking, these are arising from normal subgroups of gamma of different orders. But put differently, or more broadly, again, you know, you don't expect that you're only going to be working with abelian representations when this is a non-abelian group. So, but the thing is, you can start to see explicitly on a finite lattice these higher dimensional phase factors coming into play. And so, as you let the number of cells grow, it becomes clear that you're going to get all possible ranks of phase factors. And so, it suggests that there might be infinitely many Brillouin zones for a single material. Now, one for each R, and that's a major departure from the Euclidean theory. I don't think it's not an unexpected. It's not a surprising thing because, again. At the end of the day, from a mathematical point of view, this is really about studying the L2 representation theory of a non-abelian group. Okay. But you know, the interesting thing is that you know you can work at finitely many cells, and you can cut it off somewhere at some rank R. And these higher rank representations of gamma, the spaces of these representations, again inherit complex structures. And they're irreducible representations. And then you can think of them, you can recast them as moduli spaces of stable holomorphic bundles. So the mathematical result that allows us to go back and forth between these interpretations, you know, as you could think of them as flat unitary connections. You could think about them as representations of gamma, which is the fundamental group, by the way, of the surface, or as moduli spaces of stable holomorphic bundles of some rank. So Narasimhan and Seshadri combined with Riemann-Hilbert allows us to go backwards and forwards between this. Okay. So this finite lattice approach is in a paper that I wrote with Joseph in PNAS. And I would broadly term this as the physics approach, where we're looking just at the finite lattice, but we talk about what happens as you start to think about the thermodynamic limit and let the number of cells go to infinity. But you know this is not that limit is purely sort of coarse thinking. There's no you know we're not making the claim that you can capture the whole L2 spectrum that way. In fact, you know it's not again, capturing the L2 spectrum in terms of modes is again, an old and very, very hard problem. And it's a very noisy spectrum, and you don't really expect that you're going to be able to get away with thinking only about finite rank representations, even if you're thinking about all finite rank representations. You know, the real, you know, this problem becomes difficult because you do have to think about infinite dimensional representations when you take this limit. Okay. And I wrote a paper recently with Akash Nag. He's a postdoc at UC Santa Barbara. He actually was a postdoc in Waterloo at one point, and working with Ruxandra and Spiro and Benoit and others. He's been on the market, so I'll just say that he's a really excellent and talented mathematician. And I would say that, you know, we wrote a paper recently where we kind of try and do the rigorous math approach to this, you know, focusing on the Riemann surface or the infinite lattice. And here, you know, we get an injectivity result. So using all of these phase factors, we get an embedding, we get a transform that you know, if you produce wave functions using these modes, you know, arbitrary rank but finite rank, then you get an injection into the space of all L2 wave functions, and we study that injection in some detail. Okay, so that's what happens here. Okay, so this is just a picture then of Brillouin zones, if you like. So here's the Jacobian. Think about this as some higher dimensional torus, and the topology gets more complicated. This is maybe stable rank 2 bundles, stable rank 3 bundles, and so on. Okay. If you want to be sort of really concrete about this, you know, if you take again a surface of genus 2, like the Boltzmann surface, then if you like the rank 2 Brillouin zone, so that's modular space of degree 0 rank 2 stable bundles, or really semi-stable bundles. This is homeomorphic to CP3. And it's another result of Narasimhan and Seshadri. And you know, it's sort of the fact that this is smooth is unusual because the degree and the rank are not coprime. You expect that there'll be singularities. So for general rank, these are compact but typically singular. The fact that they're singular is actually could be interesting to the physics, but that's not something that's really been thought about. But maybe that's a kind of question going forward. And I'll say also that you know, in some sense, these higher rank bundles, you can actually do some statistics here, and you can try and see that, you know, you can look at how these linear, how these combinations of modes that give rise to actual wave functions that are solutions of the original problem, you know, how they're built from these automorphic and potentially higher rank block functions. And, you know, in some sense, you know, most of the data of a wave function, you know, statistically is coming from the abelian part. So you really can think about these sort of further sequence of moduli spaces as infinitesimal corrections to the block data. Well, that's another interesting thing, and that we kind of studied that a bit in the PNAS paper. So what are some implications of all this? So hyperbolic materials inhabit a rich, if you like, 3G minus 3 dimensional complex moduli space of algebraic curves. I'm just thinking about varying the position curve here. Okay, we're going to fix the genus. You know, if you like, coordinates on the moduli space are providing maybe new non-topological invariants of materials, okay, in this you know, region, this hyperbolic region. And in some sense, you know, hyperbolic curves are like general type curves. So in some sense, you know, the topological curves coming from, or the topological materials coming from the Euclidean theory are really, in some sense, should only be a small part of the theory. You know, you can try and compactify this moduli space of curves, and you can ask, you know, what about curves that are at the boundary? Are these materials with enhanced symmetries or degeneracies? Okay. You know, the Fourier map from position to momentum, or if you like, the Abel-Jacobi map, if you want to think about this algebra-geometrically, that's never an isomorphism in the higher genus case. It is in the genus 1 case, but only after, but you have to choose a base point there, so it's not canonical. But in the higher genus case, it's never an isomorphism. However, you know, the Jacobian and the Jeith symmetric product of your curve are birationally equivalent to one another. So you have to blow down loci in the symmetric product to get the Jacobian. And the blown down loci maybe anticipate high symmetry regions in the abelian hyperbolic Brion zone. So these are all sort of questions that one maybe didn't know to ask before trying to adapt this theory to the hyperbolic regime or to the higher genus regime. There's a story here in terms of integrable systems that I was thinking about advertising, but I guess we only have about 5 minutes left, right? So,
loosely five. I mean, you can. We have the room until like 3 or something.
So. Well, if people don't mind, I'll just say something very quickly about this then. So thanks, Surya. So, you know, there's a connection maybe to integrable systems as well. So, you know, let's just restrict to the abelian Brion zone for a moment. Let's just throw away the higher rank corrections, and so. You know, we can note that first order deformations of the complex structure of the curve, of the position curve, correspond with those of the Jacobian by the Torelli theorem. Saying that the complex structure here determines the complex structure there and vice versa. So, suppose now I think about hyperelliptic position curves. So for instance, every genus 2 curve is necessarily hyperelliptic. Hyperelliptic curves are double covers of P1. Every genus 2 cover can be realized as a every genus 2 curve can be realized as a double cover of P1, and then it's cut out by degree 2g plus 2 polynomial in an affine coordinate on P1. So suppose we're in the setting. I'm going to just focus on the Jacobian, and I'm going to think about the case just for a moment where H mod gamma is hyperelliptic. It's a double cover of P1. All genus 2 is this is like this, but I can engineer this in any genus. But for genus larger than 2, they're not necessarily hyperelliptic. These polynomials, which are in a sense equivalent to the data of the curve, comprise an affine space that supports a non-trivial fibration by tori corresponding to the Jacobians. If you like, I can look at the space of these polynomials. A point in the space of polynomials determines a hyperelliptic curve, and the hyperelliptic curve determines its Jacobian. So I have a fibration of a torus fibration over the space of polynomials. You know, because the Jacobian is the space of line bundles, the moduli space of line bundles on H mod gamma, I can choose a line bundle. I can choose a point. I can choose a momentum, an abelian momentum. That has an interpretation as a line bundle. I can take that line bundle, and it's sitting on H mod gamma. I can push it forward to P1. Because it's a double cover, I get a rank 2 bundle. But I also get an endomorphism of this bundle E that I get. And it takes values in the line bundle OG plus 1. That's where this lives. So this polynomial is cutting H mod gamma out of the total space of OG plus 1, because it's rank 2. So if I divide this by 2, I get G plus 1. And so the pushing forward this line bundle produces two pieces of data on P1, a vector bundle E and this twisted endomorphism of E, where it's twisted by if you like, G plus 1, degree G plus 1 polynomials. And by virtue of this construction, the spectrum of this linear map is precisely H mod gamma. That's because the thing that you push forward to get this map is precisely the so-called tautological section of the pullback of this bundle to itself. Just to go slightly technically into the algebraic geometry for a second, but that's just to say that there's a good reason why the spectrum of this map that you get, if the push forward involves that tautological section, then the spectrum of this map is precisely going to be the position curve. So this is bringing in now new features. In other words, I can interpret a momentum in here as a pair of a vector bundle and a rank 2 vector bundle and a twisted self-map of that vector bundle, all living on P1, and where the spectrum of this map is precisely the hyperelliptic curve, which is playing the role of the position curve for the material. So, and this is roughly speaking what one might call a Higgs bundle, but or a Hitchin pair, but it's a twisted Higgs bundle. Okay, so this realizes the position space as the spectral curve of a completely integrable Hamiltonian system, the so-called Bovell-Griffiths-Hitchin system. So this is the Hitchin system adapted This is one adaptation of the Hitchin system to genus zero. Okay. So this also makes the Jacobian, these fibers, the Liouville fibers of the integrable system, and then the complex momenta are identified with these isospectral maps, meaning they're isospectral because they all have the same spectrum, which is H mod gamma. Interpreting momenta in this way, relating it to moduli spaces of Higgs bundles in this way, identifies extra symmetries, even more symmetries. So there's this whole moduli space of these kinds of objects has a C star action, a rescaling action on it. And it has very interesting fixed points, which have the structure of they're representations of A-type quivers in the category of bundles, a twisted category of bundles on P1, so otherwise known as holomorphic chains. So you can ask, you know, do the momenta corresponding to fixed points of the C star action give rise to interesting regions in the Brillouin zone? There are other sorts of symmetries here, like anti-holomorphic involutions on the moduli space, which again might identify interesting momenta. And I'll say also here that you know, if we talk about the position curve being a hyperelliptic curve, there's a hyperelliptic involution here, okay, with the double cover. And that can play the role of a symmetry for the material as well. That itself can play the role of a symmetry because, you know, we think about materials that have time reversal symmetry, for instance. This is like a spatial reversal symmetry. So there's interesting potential points of contact between moduli spaces of Higgs bundles, you know, and vector bundles with the physics, potentially. Questions you can ask that maybe you wouldn't necessarily have asked before. And explore some of this in a paper with my former student, Elliot Pienzel. He's an undergraduate student at Maryland who's now at UC, doing his PhD at UC Berkeley. And this is a picture that Elliot drew, actually, it's a cartoon of the Hitchin system. So here are these tori I was talking about, and you can think about this as a space of this affine space of polynomials, the so-called Hitchin base, and this central degenerate fibers is the global nilpotent cone. So any of these fancy pictures that you saw in the talk, like this, were all drawn on an iPad by Elliot. So in addition to being an excellent mathematician, he's an excellent artist. So I'm just going to conclude then with some further questions. You know, again, I said this is all fine, but you know, what can you actually do here? You know, it's fine to think about this at a theoretical level, but you know, can you actually make hyperbolic matter? So is it possible to artificially engineer, say, hyperbolic states in circuits or devices? I say artificially engineer because you know, there's, in some sense, you know, topological materials in the Euclidean setting are maybe, you still have to grow them, you still have to work hard to make them, you might have to deposit them with an MBE, like molecular beam epitaxy or lithography or other sorts of techniques, plasma ion implantation. But in some sense, by the time you're done, you have what you can honestly call a material, and then under the right conditions, it behaves in this desirable and robust way. I would say that these things, if you can make them, are even more artificial. Okay? It's not that I can just engineer something that's going to, under the hood, have a hyperbolic crystal structure instead of a Euclidean crystal structure, but there might be other ways to simulate a hyperbolic state nonetheless. And so the answer is yes. And so I'm showing you a picture of an actual device. Okay, so this is a synthetic material. So this was constructed at Maryland by, originally at Princeton by the group of Alicia Koller and collaborators. So she's at Maryland now. So this paper appeared in Nature in 2019. This paper appeared, we were working on hyperbolic band theory. This paper appeared a couple of years before we published the first paper. What was interesting was that they were thinking in parallel about this, and without access to a hyperbolic band theory or any of the mathematics we talked about here, they were engineering, if you like, what's effectively a genus 2 conductor based on a septagonal lattice, a seven-sided lattice. And this is the trick here is that, you know, this is made from coplanar waveguides. It's not an electronic material, it's a photonic material. It pushes photons around, and the resonators have a variable coupling, which is just to kind of mimic the decay of the negative curvature of a of a hyperbolic lattice. I say this is the first device of this kind. People have made other sorts of devices since then, and have demonstrated various kinds of features that, in some sense, are predicted in our work on the mathematical side. What's interesting, though, is that when Kohler's paper came out, one of the comments they made, they lamented the lack of a hyperbolic band theory, and so this became extra motivation to do what we're doing. I will make a further advertisement, for Waterloo, in the sense that I have a collaborator in nanofabrication here at IQC, and we're trying to take this much, much further and make a more robust and perhaps electronic hyperbolic lattice using Josephson junctions. So this would be a superconducting device, rather. So this is more like a room temperature device. This is trying to simulate the idea of a hyperbolic lattice. Okay. But this is still an amazing feat, which is why this is a Nature paper. So just then reflecting on all this, some problems, that I could pose at this stage. Is there a full Bloch theorem for the hyperbolic crystal spectrum, on the Riemann surface? So an L2 hyperbolic Bloch theorem. Like I said, this work is very difficult in a sense. What are the meaning? I've identified various kinds of symmetries coming from moduli spaces and even from individual algebraic curves, thinking about them as covers of other curves. What is the physical meaning of these symmetries? Is there a hyperbolic crystallography? If you're talking about crystals, can you catalog them? So I made an attempt with some co-authors, which includes Alicia Kohler, but others, in this paper that was published in PhysRevB. So there's a sort of a proposal for a crystallography here. Can electronic hyperbolic circuits be engineered? That's what I was saying, is part of the work at IQC. Can they be grown or printed somewhat more naturally as films or other structures? In say, two dimensions or three dimensions. Maybe this maybe is too ambitious, but who knows? But that's really everything. So here are some of my collaborators. I'm a mathematician, giving more and more talks to physics groups. And one difference is that in physics talks, there are often pictures of people, and people get groups get thanked at the ends of physics talks. So it's something I'm starting to do. So here are some of my collaborators. So Igor Bocher, Alexei Gorshkov. This is Alicia Kohler, whose group engineered that circuit. Joseph Macheko, who I wrote the two first papers with. This is Akash, Ronnie Tamale at Würzburg. But also students, I haven't written papers with them with them yet, but I just want to advertise them. So Kazuki Aikida is a postdoc. He was at Saskatchewan, currently he's at Stony Brook. And my two PhD students who are working on this topic, Christopher Mahadeo and Sheldon Miller. And I also mentioned Elliot prefers to go by this avatar. So Elliot Kienzel drew these. So in this paper, there's about a dozen of these fantastic pictures. Seem to have caught the attention of people. And this was sort of all the rage on Twitter for a little while. But yeah, in addition to being a fantastic mathematician, Elliot's a fantastic artist. And yeah, that's everything. So thanks.
Questions received.
Looking into lattices into n-dimensional hyperbolic space, maybe not as engineered purpose, but for theoretical purposes.
No, that's a great question, even for practical purposes. I mean, because one thing would be three dimensions. Can you look at this in three dimensions or instead of two dimensions? So there, you might have to interact with Thurston geometries instead of these Fuchsian geometries. I have not done any mathematics in that regard, other than just some idle thinking about what one might need to do. But I think certain things do get much, much harder. In some sense, it's maybe easier to go from two dimensions to four dimensions, because you can still rely on complex techniques and complex moduli spaces that appear here. Three dimensions, in some sense, is maybe much harder than two or four. I have a student who's potentially going to be thinking about n equals three case, but we haven't really started working on that yet. So I'll just say that That's a perfect question, but it's all in its infancy. Yeah.
So I was going to ask, maybe you've been thinking about Betty numbers, some interesting number sequences which appear for these lattices, and how they change from dimension to dimension.
Right, and this may not be exactly what you're thinking of, but you just prompt me here because you have topological invariance associated to like the abelian Brillouin zone, for instance. In the Euclidean theory, you really want to look at the Chern class of that covering of the Brillouin zone, determined by the band structure. But then you can look at band structures now. We didn't really talk about this, but you can look at band structures plotted over higher dimensional moduli spaces of bundles. And then you can ask about the Betty numbers of those moduli spaces, and people have computed Betty numbers of like a Tiabat, just for example, Betty numbers of higher rank moduli spaces of stable bundles. You can ask what part of the physics of the material are those Betty numbers telling you about? I also don't have a good answer for that, but in principle, they should be telling you something.
Yeah, the question why complex structure is important, like from the point of view of like band structures or like physical systems?
That's a great question. To what extent is the complex structure really useful or really sort of germane to the physics here? Again, two answers. One, even in the Euclidean theory, like I said, the actual complex structure, the modulus of the elliptic curve, manifests as a parameter in the physics. In the conductivity profile, in the Hall viscosity. That's one place.
I saw that like in Hall effect, only Chern class matters for conductivity.
Well, only the Chern class matters in terms of just the broad characterization of the material. But there is, the conductivity is affected by the volume of the curve. The size of the curve will appear somewhere in the Hall resistance or in the Hall viscosity. So that's
area of like fundamental domain.
Exactly. Yeah.
But the area is not like modular invariant quantity.
It depends how you look at it. You could relate it to say the tau parameter of the elliptic curve, but I'll say something else, which maybe is more provocative. Just the fact that if I look at those higher rank moduli spaces. If I think about these just as, say, character varieties, I just think of them as topological spaces or spaces of flat connections, then there are symmetries of those spaces that you might not notice. But if you invoke the equivalence with moduli spaces of stable bundles, then all of a sudden you might have actions on these spaces that are relevant in that holomorphic, in that complex structure that you wouldn't necessarily have seen before. And like I said, if you upgrade this a little bit further and start looking at the Higgs bundle interpretation. So to bring in the Higgs bundles that we brought into, and you really need to think about, you really need to invoke the complex structure. And when you do that, like I said, now we see that there are momenta that are fixed points of for instance, a C-star action or of anti-holomorphic involutions that you wouldn't have seen before. So it at least raises the question that there may be special regions in these spaces of momenta that you wouldn't have noticed before. Now, are they actually physically relevant? Like I said, I haven't answered that question. That's an open question. It could be just that there's some volume factor, some area factor that comes into play in a mild way that doesn't really affect the actual physics. Just, if I just let that volume go to zero, then when it goes to zero, okay, now the physics has changed. But otherwise it hasn't. So it could just be that in the end. But I think it does bring up interesting questions, the existence of the complex structure. And it becomes especially, they're more visible in the higher genus case than in the genus one case. So that's how I'd answer. But as it is still speculative in a sense.
Because, like, for example, in GitHub specification and in similar stories, like, you typically to get something interesting, you're imposing additional symmetry, like CP or T. Like, mm-hmm. You consider how your material behaves under like CP and T symmetries, and this is a source from which you're getting some additional structures on your lattice or on your physical system. Mm-hmm. And like in this case, yeah, maybe there is some symmetry which is related to complex structure or which requires complex structure to be preserved or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And that was another question. Is there some interpretation for things like Selberg trace formula from this like condensed matter perspective?
Definitely, there is. And I'd recommend actually the paper for one of my collaborators, Igor Bocher, wrote a paper with a student of his precisely on interpreting the Selberg trace formula in terms of hyperbolic band theory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this has been done to an extent, and I like yeah. You should definitely look at that paper. Yeah.
Hey. Hello.
Oh, hi.
Yep. First of all, thank you for the very nice talk, Stephen.
Thanks.
I'm here for another kind of, I guess, mathematical question. Mm-hmm. So, I'm kind of surprised by the fact that you see a non-commutative Brillouin zone without inserting, like, magnetic effects, right?
Well,
you
know, I think one way to turn on a magnetic field here is to look at at degrees of bundles that are non-zero. So if you want to sort of induce Landau shifts, you know, you can look instead of degree zero line bundles, degree zero higher rank bundles, you could look at non-zero degree, and then you're still looking at similar moduli spaces. Their geometry might change slightly because you're, you know, you might be going to...
I don't think magnetic effects is just that, though, right? Because in general, induced on the lattice, there's mm-hmm. magnetic translations mm-hmm. in which, like, the maximal abelian subgroup of your fusion group is actually non-commutative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, no. In
essence... Yeah, sorry. I'm just kind of, I guess, not really surprised because, but it's just that there's this certain, I guess, tension mm-hmm. between. There's this certain tension between, the momentum space that you're considering, well, and the momentum space that you would get from, like, T Dolly, for example, from the work of Pai and Tiang.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. In some sense, I speculate a little bit about this in the paper with Elliot Kienzel. That paper is called Hyperbolic Band Theory Through Higgs Bundles. But we do think a little bit about the relationship to mirror symmetry and T duality. I will say that for me that the only way I know of inducing magnetic effects into this approach is again by considering non-zero degree, but yeah, you're right. That doesn't capture the magnetic picture fully, and I'm not sure at the moment how to go further in that aspect.
Okay, I see.
Yeah. But for me, I mean,
okay,
a lot of
thank
this,
you.
Again, it's even without magnetic effects. It's really the fact that the translation group of the tessellation is non-abelian. I think is the kind of the fundamental complication here,
mm-hmm.
mathematically.
Okay. Yeah. That does sound interesting. Actually, mm-hmm. I don't think I fully understand. But yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. It's just that there's in the Euclidean setting, there's a simultaneous diagonalization that's happening. With the translation operator and the Hamiltonian. And that's where you get a diagonalizability in terms of representations of the translation group. But here, there's that simultaneous diagonalizability fails. That's the real complication.
Right, and this is because you mentioned that there's this appearance of like rank N. Like rank and like the chi's, the characters are now, well, they're not really characters anymore, right? So
well, they're not abelian characters, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Sorry, can you just go through why this R shows up? Yeah, I missed it.
Well, again, it's really the same idea that you know, the translation group now admits higher rank representations. It doesn't purely have, it has representations actually of all ranks. And so, you know, you would expect that these will appear, you know, when you try to write down an arbitrary wave function, let's say on the finite lattice in terms of quasi-periodic functions, you're going to basically get some groupings. In some sense, you know, we just pretend for a moment that we're talking about things that have good matrix representations, even though they don't. I mean, in some sense, we're talking about Jordan blocks of all sizes. This is somehow measuring the mm-hmm. departure from the kind of extreme departure from diagonalizability.
Right. You're saying that the translation group, the maximal abelian subgroup of your fusion group, is actually not abelian without mm-hmm. magnetic effects.
Exactly.
How's that?
Well,
like,
it's just the translation group is just non-commutative to begin with.
So how do you define, by translation group, you mean the Fuchsian group is?
Yeah, the Fuchsian group that we've picked, that's, if you like, equivalent
okay.
to picking the test function. That's non-commutative to begin with, yeah.
Yeah. What I was saying about magnetic effects is that, like, the actual, like actual translations, like you have a lattice embedded in the Fuchsian group, which is abelian, commutative, but magnetic effects will make it non-commutative as an operator on your L2 space.
Right. I think there's some slight, we're probably talking about very similar things, but I think there's just some slight departure because I'm not exactly sure what you mean by embedding the lattice or the Fuchsian group in the lattice or the lattice in the Fuchsian. That there's something there that you said that I think is a bit of a departure from how I'm thinking about this.
Right. I'm thinking about like the splitting. Well, okay. I'm thinking about the decomposition of like space group the space group into like translations and point group.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I'm sure we can sort this out pretty quickly. Maybe if we were sort of sitting down, you know, together kind of at the board, or then I think we could match up what you're saying with what I'm, how I'm thinking about it. I think maybe just to maybe wrap a bow on it for the moment, I'll just say that, you know, the non-commutativity is manifest from the beginning here for me, you know, from the choice of the group.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. But let's talk more about it. It would be nice to sort out, you know, how you're thinking about it, how I'm thinking about it. But thanks for the questions.
Yeah, thank you.
Great. Being mindful of the time, I suggest we reserve further questions for later, and thanks, Steve, again.
No, thanks so much.